From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Our last show of the year is always a collection of our favorite segments from the previous 12 months. We call it a best of show. But in 2020, we joked that maybe we should call it a worst of show. But the truth is that despite this year's epic terribleness, we were still able to find stories of joy, wonder, and inspiration. It's pretty fascinating to listen back as the tone of the show shifts from blissful ignorance in January to cautious jokes about washing our hands in March, embracing sourdough and puzzles in April, and the roller coaster of hope, frustration, and resignation that has dominated our emotional psyche this year. When we polled the team at Good Food, one segment stood out as a favorite for pretty much all of us. A book about the philosophical, social, and political issues surrounding cultured meat is like a siren song for us at Good Food. We live for these existential discussions around our diet. And writer, historian Benjamin Wergath's book, Meat Planet, did not disappoint. We first aired this conversation in February.
It's such a pleasure to have you. I mean, this book that you've written, Meat Planet, is so dense with ideas to just think about and ponder. It's so complicated, and it's bizarre how it all is triggered by this idea of producing meat from a petri dish. Describe what watching the reveal of the first petri dish hamburger was like.
Well, I should say that for starters, I was really sleepy. I was living in Los Angeles, and the reveal was in London, and I got up early in the morning to watch it via an internet feed. And I felt a little bit like I was watching the future emerge through a scanner darkly. I was sort of seeing it emerge as I think thousands of other people around the world were. And it was like an early 21st century version of one of the world's fairs of the 19th century, where things that are said to be the house of tomorrow, the food of tomorrow, the everything of tomorrow were unveiled. And Mark Post, the Dutch scientist whose lab created the first in vitro cell-based burger, unveiled it, and a panel of tasters ate it and talked about its sensory properties. And it's very, very weird to think about not the future of a flying car or a space shuttle or a driverless car or something that we can see, but to witness the future of food emerging when we can't eat it, when we can't smell it, when we can't taste test it, as you did the Impossible Burger on an episode of Good Food.
You talk about seeing this introduction through the lens of, quote, the emergence metaphor. Could you explain?
The emergence metaphor is just my effort to grapple with what it's like for something to not be here yet. And I should start by just sharing with our audience the fact that laboratory-grown meat, sometimes called cultured meat, sometimes called clean or cultivated meat, doesn't exist as of this conversation as a consumer product. It may not. My book is about the quest to create it and the possibility of it, but it is unlike the various famous plant-based meats that I think we've all heard a lot about, in that it's still in its test phases. It exists, but in such small quantities that we probably couldn't fill the two recording booths we're sitting in with what's been made so far.
And in all of these technological interventions, there is always an externality or, quote, unintended consequence. And it's very hard to grasp what those externalities may be with this because of its philosophical messiness.
If I can try to speak to that a little bit, the nonprofit organization, a group whose work I really love called New Harvest, once set up a number of, they're called tea flasks, these plastic trays used to grow cells in media. They took the number of them that Mark Post's team had taken to make their two or three burger patties, And they set them up on a table at a conference as a kind of object lesson. And it was a mountain of plastic. It looked like an architect's model of a city of the future, all in plastic. And that's one way to think about the externalities that you mentioned, that there are all kinds of costs that the simple images of the future don't show us. So if you were to take, say, a plant-based burger, there's still plants to grow and things to process and things to extrude. And as a result, all kinds of environmental footprints to that burger, they may not be as great as those of a conventional beef patty. Certainly, the releases from the companies suggest that they're not. But when we're talking about the nexus of food and tech, there are always questions about what's trustworthy and how transparent companies can be, given that one of the things they usually need to do is to build and protect intellectual property, which means that there are lots of things I wish I could tell you about the near future of lab-grown meat that I just can't because of the necessary black boxing.
So you write that the modern human condition is characterized by an inherent disharmony between our biology and our technology. I just love this sentence so much. So could you speak a bit to that and also where capital markets figure into this disharmony? Because it seems that a lot of these new marvelous worlds of food that are being explored happen because there's all this capital that needs to find a home.
Well, as I was wandering through this world, which the people in it call a space, they call it the food space. And I kept wondering if astronauts refer to space as the space space. I felt like people were trying to create internal frontiers. So you go to the frontier and you find resources there, maybe oil, maybe other precious minerals, and you take those and you extract them. And the frontier provides you a place to invest capital in pursuit of more. It's part of a growth picture of what capitalism does, how capitalism works. And that sentence that you picked out about how our technologies might not be in harmony with our bodies, our biology, it's an interesting place to go because it's actually something that this biological anthropologist Richard Rangham said and that I took as data. It wasn't sort of a thing I was trying to endorse myself, but observing him say, well, he thinks that we have these prehistoric minds and we have nukes, and that's a dangerous combination. And I found myself thinking, well, he's right. In a certain way, many of our technologies and many of our ways of using technology don't have a ton to do with actual biological need. And there was a spectacular illustration of what you're describing at one conference that I went to in which a consulting firm had gathered what they would call, and the pun is intentional, stakeholders from all areas of what they would call the protein space. So people from big food companies from around the world, and brought 50 of these people together into a room with a few oddball people like me. And they said, well, we're going to have incredible protein shortfalls by 2040. We're going to have 50% more aspirational meat consumption, and we're going to have, because of climate change, way less farmland. And we already use 75% of our available farmland for animal agriculture. And a nutritionist stood up. And the nutritionist, who I think taught up at Columbia, raised her hand and said, well, did you consult a nutritionist about this? Because we don't think there's going to be this tremendous protein shortfall that will require the development of new products. And I don't know what community of nutritionists she was claiming to speak for, but I thought that discrepancy between what she thought our needs would be, what this world of food experts thinks our needs might be, and what these companies hope our needs will be, because it gives them a place to develop products and like you said, to park capital.
One thing that I thought was really interesting was this idea that you posed about whose culture is being recultured, that this work seems to be the province of the white Anglo-European male.
Yeah, so this is an old history in people thinking about the future of food. I always want to give a shout out to Warren Belasco and his book, Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food, which is a spectacular book that I think everybody who's thinking about the topic should look at. And it's partly the history of white guys planning the diet for a small planet for other people. And it goes back to the 1798 publication of Malthus's essay on the principle of population, which is the original bummer, the original news that agricultural productivity tends to fall short of population growth. And Malthusians go back to this and they use it as a reason to limit population, as a reason to plan for grim futures of food shortfalls. And cornucopians, people who believe in a future of abundance, tend to argue against them and say, well, look, we can improve agricultural productivity in all these ways, and we've tended to. There's a history of this. And people have these intense ideological arguments that are often held within places like think tanks and governments, and not necessarily with any kind of conversation with the broader world that they're trying to plan the feeding or starvation of. And Meat Planet tries to skewer that a little bit and ask what kinds of conversations the world could have about what diet might be like without the dominance of that kind of expert culture.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you so much.
That's writer and historian Ben Wergaft. He spent 5 years researching the social and political issues surrounding cultured meat for his book, Meat Planet.
Coming up, Pascal Baudard has been fermenting foods long before it was a pandemic trend. He shares his fascinating exploits fermenting wild foods next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. One of the bright spots of 2020 was rediscovering our love of all things fermented. As we know from our love affair with sourdough bread, yeasts are everywhere, and putting them to good use to transform what we eat is a fascinating endeavor. But noted wild food researcher Pascal Baudard takes fermentation a step further by applying it to the materials that he forages in the wilds of Southern California.
Hi.
Bonjour.
It's always so great to check in with you and find out what crazy wild man experiments you've been doing.
It is a bit crazy in a good way.
In a good way. Everything is always so delicious. You've been on this adventure of exploring the natural world and creating delicious foodstuffs with foraged materials, what you call wildcrafting.
Right.
But what came first, your love of foraging or an appreciation for fermented foods?
The love of nature. That's really what came out first. And then a passion for the flavor that you cannot get anywhere else. What I call the true flavor of the land. It doesn't matter where it is, Belgium, I was in Scotland, you know. It's just the true flavor of the land.
So these days, so many of us have like stepped into the brine and played around with krauts and kimchi, but picking something wild might seem kind of edgy. So where do we start?
It's super easy. One of the most common plants that you find in the wild around here would be mustard. We are loaded with wild mustard. All the hills in May are turning yellow because of wild mustard. All invasive, by the way. Nobody's doing anything with it. It's from the Brassica family. It's a perfect candidate for fermentation. And because it's invasive, I like to use every single part of it, from roots to stems to leaves to flowers and to seeds, to make mustard.
So do you make like a mustard kraut?
Yes, I call that the mustard kraut. Mustard kraut, yeah. Mustard kraut. And it's basically like, you know, you You can start very simple. And the book actually starts super simple with mixing like maybe 15% of mustard. And then you keep moving through the book and you're going to get more and more extreme a little bit.
So the base is still cabbage at sort of this kind of 101 wild fermenting.
In the beginning of the book, we're going to start working with kimchi base, sauerkraut base. So we keep it simple. And it's kind of an invitation for the reader to start exploring bit, but by gradient. And all the plants that I use in the book are really the most common wild edible that you're going to find in your yards or close to nature. And I would say like 95% of them are what we consider weeds and invasive.
So can we make a dandelion kraut?
Totally.
And what kind of flavor does dandelion have once it's fermented? How does it transform?
See, dandelion is a little bit better if you do like a kimchi kind of things. I like to mix things together. So dandelion has a base of bitterness, but also earthy. So you mix that with different spice, a little bit of curry, a little bit of chili, a little bit of garlic. You can even add, you know, herb de Provence if you wanted to, or Italian herb. So you can really start experimenting and mix it, but you actually get flavor that you don't get anywhere else. I mean, dandelion is sold now, but, you know.
But it's still different than the kind we would pull out of our
yards. You're not going to find a dandelion kimchi or dandelion sauerkraut anywhere. That's for sure.
In the process of working on these recipes and walking through the forests and experimenting, were there some plants that were less successful?
Yes, nasturtium. My God, that was gross. I tried that one. I tried fermenting that one. I really, because I love the flavor. And man, when I fermented it, that was bad. Stinging nettle is another one. I wanted to do a paste, like a fermented paste of stinging nettle. And when I opened it, it was the sensation of falling headfirst into a cow pie. So I've done mistake. I mean, not mistake, like thing that didn't work. They're not in the book. But yes, that was interesting.
So every time you come to visit me, you bring me a tiny little precious jar of wild
mustard seeds.
Of wild mustard.
Yeah, Dijon, wild Dijon.
It is truly the best mustard I've ever tasted in my life. And I almost eat it just out of the jar, like quarter teaspoon by quarter teaspoon until it's gone. What makes that so special? Just the difference of the wild seed?
The difference of the wild. And I can tell you, I touch about it at the end of the book, but I'm also in a new journey a little bit, because the more I get experience of dealing with wild plant, the more I'm a little bit frustrated by the sense that all those wild plants are considered invasive and non-native, and they are not used whatsoever. They may be crop in different country, but here locally, we only look at them as weeds. And I tell you, if you take a look at the amount of wild food that is quote-unquote invasive, it's probably the biggest food waste in Los Angeles. Food waste is so, like, trendy right now, but nobody's looking at this. I mean, you have hundreds of thousands of acres of wild mustard, nobody's doing anything with it. And you only have two solutions. It's always spraying chemicals, herbicides, or you do habitat restoration and you just throw away all the resource. And what I'm trying to do with this book and also with what I do is to look at environmental solutions, like making food as part of the environmental solution for all those non-native and invasive. And that's kind of like my journey right now.
One of the things in your journey that I've been most fascinated about, and I've been lucky enough to taste them, and they're fantastic, are your plant-based cheeses.
Right.
And I remember when you first started this journey, I thought, this man is going to kill himself. But instead, you really have come up with something that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And really shows off the environment and the way you finish them.
Yes.
So could you describe a little bit about your process?
So it's basically lacto-fermented cheese, and you can make cheese with acorn. You can make cheese with all kinds of different walnuts that you find, including chestnuts. And the basic principle is super simple. You make a paste. And in order to make a paste, usually you add water in a Vitamix. You can use a stone grinder too, by the way. But instead of using water, I will use the juice of like a sauerkraut juice or brine or kimchi brine or whatever. And then I will grind my nuts, you know, make a paste out of it, and it will start fermenting automatically because I've introduced the lactobacteria in it. I make it a little bit too salty, which is good. The bacteria like salt too. And then I put them into a towel and put a weight on it, so it squeezes out the excess juice. After 2 or 3 days of fermentation, I remove the cheese and then I shape it. And everything is about the crust. And like I always say, a good relationship is based on trust, and with the cheese, it's based on crust. I take wild herbs. I will take all kinds of leaves and all kinds of different stuff and create those really beautiful crust. That kind of represents what the cheese is all about. So they're very, very, very pretty, but they are also very, 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 very good, you know. And inside, you're going to put flavoring, like a little bit of cheese flavoring, so nutritional yeast, a little bit of miso maybe. I'm going to use herbs powder, wild seeds sometime, aromatic plant. It's kind of like each cheese is special. It's a little bit of a piece of art.
Another thing that I found really moving that you talk about in the book is when fires swept through the area that you used for foraging and for classes, for taking so many of your walks with students, and how you sat there and looked at this area that was just devastated.
Oh my God, yes, it was a desert. And then?
And then?
And then I say, well, what can I do? And I love it. I always look at, you know, I love challenges. Challenges make me, I, for whatever reason, they make me more creative. And I start looking at ashes. I'm like, well, I'm making cheese right now. Ashes are used by French, you know, on top of cheese to avoid mold. So I started foraging different ashes. And I collected ashes from oak trees, ashes from willow trees, and all kinds of different stuff. And started playing with it on my cheese.
But that log.
Oh, the log, fermenting in the log too. I was also super interested. I had nothing beside ashes and logs really at that point. And they cut, you know, they were cutting different trees that were about to fall down, and there was this beautiful log, oak log. And I realized that, you know, in France and Belgium, we are going to age our wine or beer in, you know, oak barrels because of the flavors that the oak can impart. And I became fascinated. I'm like, why not fermenting in an oak barrel? So I created this oak barrel out of this branch, and I started fermenting in it. And my God, it was so different. You get this kind of like oaky flavor a little bit in a good way. I mean, I don't know. I think oak has like more than 150 flavorful compounds in it. You can taste the wood in a good way. And you can taste also the fire in a good way. You know, it was fascinating. I loved it.
Pascal Baudard is a wild food researcher and instructor in traditional food preparation and techniques. His latest book is Wildcrafted Fermentation. Back in April, when the strain on our food supply became clear, we reached out to Jay Singh, a 29-year-old long-haul trucker whose job is getting products to grocery store shelves. Jay was an essential worker before the pandemic, during the peak of the virus, and he will continue to be one once this is all over. His story is one of the most memorable segments we did this year. We first learned about Jay's story in Sam Block's piece for The Counter. Hi, Jay.
Hello, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. When did you decide to get into the trucking business, and how long have you been on the road?
All right. So I've been driving for 9 years now. I started when I was 20. I got my license when I became 21. I live in Bakersfield, California. It's a small town between LA and Fresno. And all my trips are from California to Texas, from California to Pennsylvania, and all the places in between, like Louisiana, Mississippi, is different every time I go.
And what is it that you're hauling?
From last 5 years, I've been hauling produce, basically vegetables, spinach, lettuce, to all over the country.
Before the outbreak began, what did a typical day look like for you?
I would start my day at 9 a.m. in the morning, and I would drive until 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. and I would park my truck and go to sleep in my truck. But since all this virus thing is going on, there are many places which are closed, and there are many rest areas, picnic stops that are being closed right now. So it's hard to find parking these days for that kind of big truck. So I start my day at 4 a.m. in the morning every day so I can park around 4 p.m. or 5 p.m. so I can get a spot.
And I also understand that stopping to refresh yourself to either eat or use the restroom has become more problematic as well.
Yes, because we are the ones who go to different warehouses, and those warehouses supply food to big names like Walmart, Costco. And whenever we go there, usually they have their restrooms open for everybody. But these days, they are shutting down all the restrooms for all the drivers. It's just their own employees who can go in there. And whenever we ask them, hey, can we use your restroom? They are like, no, it's against our company policy. We cannot have anybody use our restroom due to this coronavirus. So I asked them, where do I go? And they were like, just wait in a truck and wait for us to get you unloaded. Then you can use the restroom at any truck stops. And it's getting worse day by day.
Tell us about the network of restaurants that line the trucking routes. What kind of food is available to you? And have you talked to any of the owners of those restaurants?
Yes, I did. There's a restaurant in Gallup, New Mexico called Bombay Grill. So usually they have big sitting area for all the customers. But these days they are just shutting down because it's not allowed for them to have people sitting inside the restaurant because it's going to be a little dangerous for everybody. So they are shutting down the restaurants for indefinite time. I asked them, they were like, probably it's going to be for a month or it might be more, depend on the virus. And all these places like Denny's, other Country Pride restaurants, everything is getting closed because we cannot sit in there. Only few restaurants do the takeout orders, and that's where I'm getting my food from these days. If this restaurant is closed and I had to get to the other one, which is like maybe 60 miles away, so I would drive 60 miles more just to get my food.
And then when you are able to go home, do you keep yourself separate from the family because you've been out so much?
Yes. Actually, I just started doing this from last 1 week. I've been going to places which might be infected with the virus. And as soon as I come home, I just do my laundry inside my garage and then proceed to get in my house. And I have my separate room from my family. So I just use that only single room. I don't sit in a living room for at least, it's going to be for 1 month more, because it's dangerous for my family too.
I mean, I know truckers are used to spending a lot of time alone, but the isolation must be even more extreme for you.
Yes, because before that, I would come home, I would play with my family, I would go out, I would take them out. And being alone on the road for 10 days and coming home and then staying alone again for the next 2 days, it's kind of psychologically so hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I also imagine that the responsibility that you feel now is heavier than ever before. Do you feel an obligation to keep driving because you know that the country is relying on you?
Yes, of course, because my family, they are also telling me to stop driving because they are concerned for me. I'm going places. But there's got to be someone who's got to do it. So if I stop, there's going to be less food on the shelves. For this, everybody's going to be affected. Even if I stop, somehow my family will be affected in the future. Because if everybody thinks like that, we're not going to have food on the shelves. Trucking is the major part of the economy and our community to keep the people fed.
Jay, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us.
All right. Thank you so much.
That was Jay Singh, a long-haul trucker based in Bakersfield. Visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood to read Sam Block's story about Jay for The Counter. In a minute, a marvelous piece of writing about rotten apples. And we hear from one scholar who believes food can heal divisions. Our Best of 2020 show continues after the break. You're listening to Good Food's Best of 2020 show on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. One of our favorite segments this year is a short story about apples, rotten apples. Helen Rosner is the New Yorker's roving food correspondent. In June, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd by the hands of a white policeman in Minneapolis, she wrote an essay titled How Apples Go Bad. The essay is fronted with a quote from Robert O'Brien, White House National Security Advisor. It says, "There's a few bad apples that are giving law enforcement a terrible name." Here's Helen.
An apple tree in bloom is a thing of majesty. Arm-like branches held aloft in an eternal pose of praise, or perhaps exasperation, wreathed in a stippled cloud of blossoms. Bees rest on the flower's quivering stamens to sip their golden nectar, then move in drunken joy to another tree, their legs and backs powdered with pollen. When the pollen from one tree's flower meets the pistil of the flower of another, a small miracle of creation occurs. Apples take months to grow. The fruit from a flower fertilized in April may not reach maturity until October or November. Only then will it begin to ripen. All apples are born from members of the same species, Malus domestica. But in a manner more familiar to us in Animalia than plantae, their offspring don't grow true to seed. The child of a round speckled winesap and a muscular Gravenstein might resemble one or both of its parents, or it might go off on a path entirely of its own. The calculated sweetness of a Honeycrisp, the astonishing ruby flesh of a pink pearl, the early ripening of a Carolina red June, the bumps and warts of a knobbed russet. There are thousands and thousands of named cultivars and innumerable varieties unnamed. Perhaps owing to these gonzo genetics, apples are remarkably susceptible to disease and rot. Their tender skin and light flesh are a haven for small creatures. Their trees embrace myriad molds, viruses, and fungi. Apple scab, black pox, southern blight, union necrosis. For farmers and hobby gardeners, the business of apple growing is not so much aiding the fruits in their growth as scrambling to ward off their demise. Blight spreads quickly, and it's not always apparent on the fruit's surface. Even without the influence of invader or infection, an apple abets its own spoilage. Its skin, minutely porous, exhales ethylene, a gaseous compound that induces ripening, and the fruit has no interest in stopping at the point where it serves our needs. The closer an apple is to rot, the more rot it spreads. One spoiling apple in a crisper drawer or a fruit bowl or a storage barrel or a cross-country shipping container or even still hanging on the bough speeds the rot of every apple it touches and even of ones it doesn't touch. The whole bunch quickly begins to exemplify what the artist Klaus Oldenburg called the brown, sad art of rotting apples, a swamp of ferment, infecting the air with the hideous sweetness of decay. Chaucer was likely the first to write a version of the now commonplace proverb, a rotten apple's better thrown away before it spoils the barrel. But I'm partial to Benjamin Franklin's version, the rotten apple spoils his companions. The saying is often used to refer to the corruption of select individuals within a group, but the point is the fruit's susceptibility to collective rot. We are in the war zone against this disease, George Sundin, a fruit tree pathologist at Michigan State University, said in 2019 about fire blight, the most recent major threat to apples. The process of eradicating it is not necessarily trial and error, he added. It is things we know are effective, but they need to be more effective. If the disease takes off, it can spread so quickly. The only way to avoid rot is to be proactive. Check every apple, every tree. At the first sight of something amiss, a bruise or broken skin, a sunken place, toss that apple out, but don't stop there. Scrub all the others and monitor them closely, but know that it's likely already too late. Better to trim and burn the infected branch, or even the whole tree.
That was Helen Rosner, roving food correspondent at The New Yorker. For more of her work, go to newyorker.com. The entire year, and this past summer in particular, has been a time of social ferment, both in and out of the food world. Moving through this extraordinary year, I realized we were fighting two pandemics, COVID-19 and racism. For many of us, food is a comfort, a balm, but food can also be a weapon. Adrienne Miller is a historian and author who acknowledges both, but he believes that food has the ability to reconcile.
When you sit down at a table with someone, you recognize their humanity. And cooking is an act of love, because when somebody cooks food for you, they're saying that they care about your survival.
Adrienne goes by the moniker Soul Food Scholar. He was the deputy director of President Clinton's Initiative for One America. Now he focuses on the intersection of faith and food. Hi, Adrienne.
Hi, good to be with you.
I'm so happy to have you. You call yourself a recovering lawyer and politico. The Initiative for One America, of which you were the deputy director during the Clinton time, what work did it focus on?
So it focused on racial, ethnic, and religious reconciliation. And the underpinning of it was the wild and crazy idea that if we just sat down and talked to one another and listened, we might realize that we have a lot more in common than what supposedly divides us.
And what years were you doing this work?
So I was there from 1999 to 2001. So I was at the very end of President Clinton's second term.
Do you think this moment is substantively different to effect another stab at moving the needle?
I think it is different because there have been times before where I thought we would be in this moment, really 5 years ago with the murders of the Bible study group at the AME church in Charleston, South Carolina. I thought that was going to be a triggering event, kind of like the bombing of the Birmingham church that killed the four little girls in the early 1960s, how that further galvanized the civil rights movement. Anecdotally, I can just tell you, it seems like more white people are paying attention, want to learn, and want to engage on the issue. I just haven't seen this level of concern and wanting to do something before.
You know, so often on this show, and in the media in general, we talk about food as a way to bring us together over the table, but so often that just feels completely ingenuous. There's a flip side. Food can just as easily be weaponized to tear us apart, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we have a deep history of that in this country, and I think it happens around the world as well. But I think particularly of the way food was weaponized against African Americans in the late 1800s. Stereotypes of African Americans and certain foods had certainly been floating around in our culture. But at a moment when African Americans had a modicum of civil and social and political rights, there was a propaganda campaign by cultural tastemakers that basically used food to make African Americans seem weird or childlike or even bestial. And the idea was like, look, you gave these people these rights. They don't really deserve them. Here's why. And it wasn't just in the South. Editors and people outside the South were happy to recycle these harmful images. And the most toxic were fried chicken and watermelon. And the goofiest thing about that, two things, is one, watermelon and fried chicken are delicious. And two, white people were eating those same foods. But it just shows you the power dynamic, how the stigma could be attached to African Americans. So much so that even today, I know people who are reluctant to eat fried chicken and watermelon around whites. And at least be photographed or filmed doing it.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And angering. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben being shown the door.
Yes. So I think it's long overdue. And I think it's kind of really interesting to see the reaction, both from African-Americans and whites about this, believing that these food figures are being erased, but they don't know the history. Aunt Jemima, Faustus, for Cream of Wheat and Uncle Ben, they go back to a time where society said Black people had a certain role, and your role was servitude. And so you were supposed to be the happy servant and meet all the needs of whites. And so that's the background. That's the history, the roots of those images. Now, that history has not been passed on. So now we have people reacting to the removal in kind of very interesting and shocked ways, but they just don't know that history and what messaging those images sent, especially to African-Americans.
I know that you're working on an upcoming book on barbecue called Black Smoke. Has barbecue also been weaponized?
Yeah, so we focus kind of on fried chicken and watermelon, but barbecue was on the list of foods that essentially were used as fodder for creating caricatures of African-Americans. Really racist stuff. And so 100 years ago, Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville, which were kind of entertainment circles in our society, there were things called like the Darktown Barbecue. And you would see just kind of coon images of African-Americans. And you see this not only in kind of literature and art and music, but you see it in film. There's several films that talk about African-American barbecues, the spectacle of it. But again, it was the idea to show that African-Americans were somehow weird and at the same time showing them as servants, because the idea was that Black people existed to make the very best barbecue. So 100 years ago, if you were thinking about the standard bearers for barbecue, it was African-Americans.
So let's talk about your book, Black Smoke, in a bit more detail. Is it strictly history?
It starts out with the premise that, hey, African-Americans have long been the standard bearers for excellent barbecue. Not the only ones. Of course, other people cooked barbecue, but people equated great barbecue with African-Americans. And so it's really weird to be in this present time where in the media, very few African-American barbecuers get love. So the idea is to go back to the roots and kind of trace the history and just make the case for why African-Americans deserve much more attention and credit when you're talking about barbecue in this country.
So I'm sure that one part of this kind of research is eating, but what else does it involve?
Is there anything else that should be involved? No, I'm just kidding. So part of it was going through those oral histories of enslaved people and just seeing how barbecue evolved in the antebellum period. And why were enslaved African Americans the ones forced to make barbecue? And before that, it was enslaved Native Americans. So it was parsing that. And then just reading old digitized newspapers and magazines, because those media platforms were really about capturing daily life in the life of a community. And in a lot of those publications, they talked about these African-Americans. Now, it wasn't until the late 1800s that they started to actually give these barbecuers name. But by the late 1800s, they named them, they kind of interviewed them and asked them for their techniques and secrets. And that's just the level of recognition that you don't see in other aspects of cooking around that time. So barbecue had a certain reverence attached to it.
Currently, you're the executive director of the Colorado Council of Churches. You're the first African-American and the first layperson to hold that position. The mission of the group is to walk together in faith, work together for justice. Where does food justice come into your work there?
So it's been really interesting. There's been a real awakening within Christian circles about dealing with issues of food justice, because for the longest time, churches have definitely responded in terms of charity. We have food banks, you know, pantries. When an emergency happens, we show up. But there's more thinking about, okay, why are people constantly hungry? Why is food insecurity such a persistent problem? And that means changing the system, and that means questions of justice. So what you're starting to see are more churches using their vast acreage of land to actually have community gardens, to teach people how to farm on their own property. So we're seeing a lot of interesting things there. We're seeing more people try to use food as a tool of reconciliation. One of the best events that we had at the Council of Churches is a couple years ago, and this was right after the murders of the Bible study group in Charleston, South Carolina. By chance, we were already working on this, but we had a big potluck. And we just said, bring food from your tradition, sit down at the table and just talk to somebody you don't know and then see if there's ways that your churches can do work together to build fellowship. And the idea was to pair black and white churches. And it was interesting because, you know, some people showed up with vegan soul food. So I had to say a quick prayer, but it was very good. In fact, vegan is one of the hottest trends in soul food. But I have to tell you, before that event, there was a lot of cynicism from black pastors. They just did not think that white churches really wanted to do the lengthy and hard work of reconciliation. And a few churches did enter those partnerships. But sure enough, after a few weeks, one of the white pastors told me, yeah, my congregants are kind of wondering why we keep doing this. And that just reinforced what the black pastors thought.
Well, we have to hope for this moment to deepen and stay.
Amen.
Why do you think that food creates a moment for us to come together? And what do you think the meaning is of that?
Well, I think in this time, because we have so few spaces now where we can come together and in so few ways to come together, I think food is one of those that can work because we all have to eat. And when you sit down at a table with someone, you know, you recognize their humanity. And cooking is an act of love because when somebody cooks food for you, they're saying that they care about your survival. They're saying that they love you in a way. I mean, even if the food is straight nasty, right? The act of cooking is showing some love. And what I've found in my work with the Clinton White House and other arenas is that when there are race dialogues, if it's just about coming together to talk about race, they usually dissipate after several meetings because they just lose steam for whatever reason. But whenever the race dialogue is tied to some other activity that brings people enjoyment and gives people a chance to get to know each other and build relationship, those seem to have more staying power. So I think food allows us to kind of relax, maybe put our guard down a little bit, explore another culture and start to get to know people and build relationships that can be the foundation for then talking about the really tough things.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you.
That was historian and author Adrian Miller, a.k.a. Soul Food Scholar. He's the author of two award-winning books and is currently writing Black Smoke, African-American Adventures in Barbecue. After a quick break, we revisit an extraordinary story of a beloved restaurant right here in Los Angeles. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Telling the stories of our local restaurant community this past year has been both the most difficult and most rewarding part of my job. The restaurant industry and the people behind it have suffered extraordinary loss during COVID, and yet amidst the heartbreak are extraordinary stories of tenacity and passion. In September, we started a weekly segment called In the Weeds. It's a collection of first-person accounts from restaurateurs about how the pandemic has changed their life and their business. And I want to wrap up this year of Good Food by replaying one of these segments. It's the story of Anna Jack Thai with chef and owner Justin Pichet-Rungsi.
My name is Justin Pichet-Rungsi. I'm the chef owner at Anna Jack Thai restaurant here in Sherman Oaks. Anna Jack is a restaurant that was started by my father. We opened in 1981. My father started it then, and we've been in the same location in Sherman Oaks as a neighborhood spot for 39 years. And we have a lot of regulars. I would say that most of our customers are regulars, folks that have been in Sherman Oaks and in the Valley for a while. And I grew up here. I grew up in the back. I grew up in the kitchen. I grew up in the front of the house, watching my father work behind the wok. I mean, seeing him super charming behind the tables, seeing my parents work together. I mean, my parents would always have me front of house, you know. They'd push me out to the tables. They'd say, go, go, go. Go to table two and introduce yourself. I'm like, you're not going to come with me? And they're like, no, no, no. Just tell them. You're Rick's son. Go say hi. Go say hi. And it's that kind of spot. My dad's originally Cantonese by way of Bangkok. He was born in Bangkok and was always a hustler when he was a little kid, worked in clubs and bars and hostess bars and hotels when he was 13. He's just been like in the hospitality industry his whole life. And when he came here in his 20s, he was working as a tempura cook, a fry cook at a Japanese restaurant, pretty popular Japanese restaurant, simultaneously at Jack in the Box. And he eventually moved his way up in the Japanese restaurant called Miyako until he became the head sushi chef. And back then, there wasn't a lot of like non-Japanese sushi chefs, but he's very good at cutting fish. And all of his staff meals that he would make would be Thai, obviously. After 12 years of working in at Miyako and doing Japanese food, he said to his boss, "I think I'm going to open up my own spot." And there he was with just by himself, opened up this tiny little spot here. We expanded just to the tenant next door shortly thereafter. But he's 71 years old now. He had a stroke about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And so he doesn't cook anymore. But I'm very fortunate that he was able to teach me how to cook when he was still behind the wok, still on the line. I mean, he was on the line, you know, his whole life. It was his dream to open the restaurant. And there it is. Before I worked at Anajack, and before this became my full-time thing, I was working as a concept artist and an art director at the Walt Disney Company in Imagineering and in Interactive. I didn't know how I was going to make it over to making the restaurant a full-time thing. You know, when you're working a big, you know, corporate job, you have these dreams and you're just, you never know how those things are going to happen. After my father's stroke, my mother said, well, I mean, I know you don't want to think of it this way, but the universe is giving you an opening to finally do what you've always wanted to do. Being a restaurateur now feels, as it always has felt, a very multidisciplinary job. And it is very stressful because things are changing so fast. I mean, we've seen so many changes in the last 6 months, and you can see that as like one big change because of COVID. But every week it feels a little bit different. When we finally like moved into the phase where I said, you know what, I want to be creative now. I don't want to feel confined anymore. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do, because if it works, then cool. If it doesn't work, nothing was working anyways. So why not just try it? And I was making tacos for staff meal. So my cooks are from Oaxaca and Mexico City. And it was just, I was like, just playing around. I was like trying to impress them with, you know, my taco making abilities, and, you know, got these tortillas from Princesita. And I was like, oh yeah, like very excited about, you know, doing this to impress the guys, the team. And they're like, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And I was like, you know what, maybe I'll just be a taquero for a day. Let's just try it out. So then that's how Thai Taco Tuesday started, was just trying to impress my cooks. And it just turned into a really fun way to like transform the night that was so slow, right? Tuesday nights in restaurants, so slow, into something that, you know, has energy. I thought about it recently, like, how long do I want to keep doing it this way? You know, this way is actually kind of hard. You know, how can I grow the restaurant in a responsible way? Like, I think my responsibility is to be the steward of Anajack. And it's an honor and a pleasure for me to like to take care of it, to take care of the people, to take care of the rickety, rusted building with, you know, the doors that kind of work and the burners that only work like this when you turn the knob like this. And, you know, my job has been to maintain it. And I think that in the future, my job will hopefully be to grow it and to see it continue on, hopefully at least another 40 years. I mean, I know that's insane, but I mean, I look up to all these winemakers and they're like multi-generational. I'm like, wow, isn't that incredible? I just want to continue having fun doing this because I love doing it. And let's see, if you come tonight to Anajack, you have two courses of options. One, you can make a reservation and we have a single private table in our alley. That menu is the normal dine-in menu, or you can actually do, I guess, what we're calling the Thai omakase. So that's like a coursed out sort of 10, 12 courses where I'll cook for you stuff that's off the menu, a lot of dry-aged seafood specialties, chili dips, things that I want to serve that we can't do in the form of takeout. If you can't do one of those, then actually I think the best option is do takeout. Of course, order fried chicken. Of course, get the meatballs, the lap tot. Those northern style meatballs are delicious. And grilled holdfish is probably one that I'm the most proud of. And it's typically dry aged for 1 week. And it's my father's namjim seafood sauce. So there's a little bit of me and a little bit of his vision in it.
That was Justin Peachet-Rungsi, second generation chef and owner of Anajack Thai in Sherman Oaks. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, Kat Yore, and Paul Smith. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. And to you, the listeners, thank you. Have a wonderful holiday. Stay safe, eat well, and I'll be back in 2021 with a new episode of Good Food.